The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So for this evening, I'd like to talk a little bit about posture, meditation posture. And I think that there are plenty of people who don't think that posture is that important for meditation. After all, meditation is about the mind. Calming the mind, having a peaceful mind, focusing the mind, letting go of the distractions of the mind. And so the body, the posture is kind of incidental. And so I would like to, hopefully by the end of the evening, to dissuade you of the view that meditation is just of the mind. The mind and body work closely together, so closely that it's maybe not so useful to separate them even. And a very important part of the training or the development of the peace, the calm, the concentration of meditation, the insight of meditation, has to do with the body and also with posture, what happens with your posture. So that's what we're, that's the direction of the talk today. When I was relatively new to Vipassana practice, after having done many years of Zen practice, I went to Nepal to practice at Upandita, a great Burmese teacher. He was doing a month-long retreat there. And unbeknownst to me, there were all these fairly senior American Vipassana teachers that had gone there to meditate with him too. And there was only like maybe less than a dozen of us there, Westerners, sitting there with him. And so I got to meet all these teachers. It was very nice, his fellow practitioners. And there was one of the senior American teachers. I shared a room with him. It was a teeny little room. And there was just enough space for four narrow mattresses, wall to wall. And that's our room. We slept there in that little room. And we also meditated in the room. So we were together most of the time in that room. And so we're kind of intimate. And we also would go to interviews with the teacher as a group. And Pandita had a way of deciding who was going to be first and who was going to be last. And as it was, I was always the last one. And which meant that anybody who was ahead of us in the group went first and reported their meditation experience, and then they would leave. And the people who were left would hear them. So I got to hear the interviews of this senior American teacher. And it was very inspiring. Tremendous detail, careful precision, great equanimity, being able to report his experience very well. But after a while, this is a month-long retreat, after a while, he reported having back pain. And he report in amazing detail how excruciating and painful it was. He seemed equanimous and balanced, and he was very precise, and it was kind of inspiring. But he mentioned in passing one day that if he had been back in America on retreat, he would have gone to the chiropractor. But in Kathmandu, there was apparently nothing like that to do back then. And so I was, roommates with him, two beds over. And I could see his posture when he meditated. And from my Zen point of view, Zen puts a lot of emphasis on posture, he had terrible meditation posture. He was kind of slumped all over like this, And no wonder he has a bad back, the way he's sitting. So you weren't supposed to break silence in these retreats. So with great courage or foolishness, I snuck over to him and said, "Psst." If you sit up a little bit straighter, it might help your back. And your back, your posture is not so good the way you're sitting. And he looked at me, turned and looked at me with these beautiful, compassionate eyes. He was very, very present for me. He didn't mind that I disturbed his meditation or bothered him. And he just looked at me very nicely and he said, In Zen, you do it from the outside in. In Vipassana, we do it from the inside out. So I just shrugged my shoulders and... Okay, well... you know, have it your way. And, you know, snuck back to my bed and back to sit in my Zen posture. And so this idea of, in Zen, it's a little bit of a... There's some truth to what he had to say, that in Zen, the training is often from the outside in. It's in the form. You take a form, a particular posture, or you try to do that. And with that comes some inner change and development. And Vipassana, historically, there's been very little emphasis on posture. And sometimes very little instruction on posture. And people show up and are given the basic instructions, follow your breath and pay attention. Because their posture is not attended to carefully, sometimes they go through a lot of physical discomfort that's not needed, not necessary. And then slowly, there's something happens from the inside in Vipassana, and sometimes the posture does change and mellows and opens up in a variety of ways. And if it happens rightly, it's a beautiful process from the inside out. What I like to suggest is that it can be both ways. It doesn't have to be one way or the other. And that some attention on the form of posture, the external, is very helpful for this practice of ours. We don't want to be as single-minded about posture or so completely focused on posture as the Zen tradition is. But there can be much more than we traditionally have in Vipassana. And so that's part of the theme of today, is the value of focusing on posture, kind of like from the outside in, from taking the structure, taking a good structure, taking an aligned posture and balanced posture, and the value of that. I speak on this topic a little bit from having spent years and years struggling with posture, partly because of my Zen training. I did not have good Zen posture. My teacher would come and correct me. You know, I got so many corrections. And then once in a while they wouldn't correct you, they just come over and hit you. They had this meditation stick that they hit your other shoulder. If it's done well, it feels good. since that my time in Zen Center, they've stopped using it now. And it's still, you know, a teacher for me, a training for me, the posture, and something I still focus a lot on and still have to focus on and work with. And sometimes I don't have good posture sitting up here. People sometimes come over and looked at me and said, Gil, I opened my eyes during sitting and it seemed to me like you were sound asleep. You know, bent over. So I'm still working on it. Mm-hmm. to get a sense of how important the posture is, maybe it's helpful to point out that the English word posture has these two meanings. It has the meaning of the physical stance that we take, the physical way we're aligned and aligned in our body. But it also has an attitudinal meaning. It's the attitude in which we enter into something. You know, we're posturing. We come into IMC and we're going to show who's the best meditator. So we're posturing. posturing. So there's a certain kind of attitude that gets expressed. And so I think that these two meanings are not a coincidence, but actually that what we do with our physical posture often expresses what we do with our attitude. What we're doing with our attitude comes out in our posture. And you can see that really well with young kids. I have a 5-year-old who has, it's really, really fun to watch his posture because it's like this attitude kind of is like open, right now still, it's like this open channel. That just gets expressed and exaggerated. I think it's exaggerated. I would never do it that way. Maybe I'm already held and repressed and whatever. But He's just so complete. So like, you know, you tell him that, we can't have ice cream today. And he goes completely limp. He just, you know, and, you know, sometimes he gets so limp, you know, he falls on the floor like, you know, like, oh. The degree of tragedy that's befallen him is just so dramatic. Oh. You know, or if he's just happy and alert, you can see this buoyancy and uprightness, and he jumps, and, you know, sometimes I take him to school, and he's so happy to go to school, he's just kind of bouncing down the sidewalk, you know. And I just feel the joy and delight. So this attitude comes through so clearly in young children. As we go older, many of us have learned how to moderate, adjust, hold our posture so we convey just the right impression. How are you? I'm fine. Boy, am I pissed. Oh boy. I just can't stand the next person who asks me that question. Oh, yes, and how are you? You know, there's a way we sometimes don't show people as clearly what's going on as we could. As if you were 5 years old, you would. But we kind of, you know, hold things, you know, in a bright, polite way. We create an impression of how we want to be seen by what we do with our posture. And of course, sometimes it's not so, you know, we don't have so much control over it. Sometimes it comes through anyway. It's clear when someone is really sad or depressed. You can kind of see it in their shoulders, and maybe their chest is sunken and they're bent over. And you see it when someone is happy and alert and they feel upright. And you can feel it, see it in the posture, you can feel it. And from a distance even, just how they walk, the sprint and things. And so there's a very intimate relationship between attitude and our physical posture that we take. And the direction, it goes in both directions. Certainly it goes in the direction that our attitude gets expressed in our posture, in our muscles. But also, the position you put your body in has an impact back on your attitude or your emotions or your psychology. And so it's possible sometimes to, you know, if you're mildly sad or mildly depressed and you find yourself slumped over in the couch, you're kind of walking around, you know, slumped over, stand up or sit up straight and feel a change in your attitude, in your feeling tone, from just that change in the posture. Open up the chest a little bit. I wish it was always that easy, but sometimes you can feel that kind of change just from changing your posture. Or if someday when you're feeling really lousy, exaggerate your posture. Get into it. And chances are it'll keep you in it longer. You know, get a really good couch, you know, sink into the back crack, disappear there. And it helps if you turn on the shopping channel. You know, really get into it. Oh, this world of mine. What does it come to? So there's a close relationship between posture and attitude, attitude and posture. And because of that close relationship, the posture we take when we meditate has an impact on us. So if you just take your native posture, whatever you sit down, whatever way you want to sit, whatever way you happen to sit without any thought about it, then the posture you sit in is going to reflect the mood, the situation, your attitude, your feelings, your holding patterns of the day or of a lifetime. And if you don't pay attention to your posture, give it some healthy attention, then your body becomes kind of like the slave of your attitude, the slave of your mental psychology, of your resistance and your holding and everything. It's been many years ago now, but I've had the experience of, it seemed like a whole bunch of people happened. You know, not a whole bunch, but, you know, maybe over 3 years, maybe four people. Where I kind of used to like more than now, but like to kind of face people directly when I talk to them. Now I'm more relaxed about it. It's kind of my Zen training. And I guess, you know, maybe I'm intimidating, but some people would turn around 90 degrees. And they wouldn't want to kind of just, you know, look directly at me. They kind of, literally 90 degrees, they look their side like this. And so I thought that was kind of interesting. So I walked around 45 degrees, and then they would turn around. And then I'd walk around 45 degrees, And they would do another 45-degree turn. And amazingly, we could do a 360-degree turn around the person. But the reason I'm telling you this is I don't believe the person knew this was happening. It was unconscious on their part. So I think that there's a way in which if we don't pay attention to our posture, it's kind of subconscious kind of way in which the posture gets shaped and formed. And what we're being asked, one of the possibilities in meditation is to begin giving some attention to your posture and also taking some responsibility for the posture you sit in. When I was at Tassajara Zen Monastery for almost 3 years, much of the day, big parts of the day sometimes were highly choreographed. You were told how to stand, how to walk, where to place your hands, all kinds of things. Everything that was done in the meditation hall, and we spent hours and hours in the day in meditation hall, was choreographed that way. You had to walk around with your hands together in shashu, with one hand in a fist, the other hand on top of it, right in front of your solar plexus, kind of. Walk around this way, to walk around looking down. You take a certain posture in the meditation hall to sit. You take a certain posture in the meditation hall to chant. You use a certain posture, of course, to bow. A particular way you have to bow, hold your body when you bowed. Particular posture when you ate, while you're eating. So all this stuff was choreographed. The way you came in the hall, the way you left the hall, everything was set up. So I was used to the 3 years of kind of being told how to hold my body, how to be. And it was a great training. I was very fond of that physical side of Zen training, and the value of it. And some other time maybe I can tell you more about the value of it. After 3 years at Tassajara, I came back to San Francisco. And I was no longer living a choreographed life. And I was amazed now how many choices I had to make for myself. It wasn't chosen for me. I had to choose for myself how I stood, how I sat. And I realized, in a way I'd never realized before, that there were a lot of choices that went into how I would sit in a chair. Or there could be a lot of choices in how I would sit in the chair. Before, I just sat in the chair. And when you sit, you just sit. But I learned that there's choices. You can kind of look at and see, am I slumping? Am I on the edge? Am I leaning against the backrest? What am I doing with my feet? My feet grounded, firmly planted on the floor and kind of stable and present. Are my feet cocked under? Am I kind of casual? All kinds of ways that are going on there. So I went to the abbot one day and told him this. I said, it was all choreographed, now it's not. And now I realize there's so many choices that I have. And I realize I have to take responsibility for these choices. And when I said that, he did something to me which I've never seen him do to me or to anybody else before. This is a formal Zen interview. He's sitting there cross-legged, I'm sitting here cross-legged. It's very formal, and choreographed that also. It's very, a little bit intimidating. He was a big guy, bigger than me. And sitting there as we were talking. So I told him this, and he put out his hand and shook my hand. Congratulations. That was a really important insight. You really understood something really important, the importance of taking responsibility for what you do in life, how you are. Something as simple as posture. So posture. So meditation posture. So the idea is to take a posture that does two things. Maybe does many things, but two primary things I would like to suggest. One is a posture that allows you to become aligned, is aligned and balanced, so you can sit pain-free as long as possible, but also so that that your body can relax and get soft as much as possible. It turns out that the cross-legged posture, I read some physiological study, they study different postures to see which postures you can get most relaxed in. And the two most relaxed postures to be in is lying down on your back and sitting cross-legged upright. Isn't that interesting? And now that's only if your body is relaxed and soft in that posture. If there are a lot of chronically held muscles where it becomes hard to hold yourself this way, or your muscles are not toned or strong enough, then it can take a lot of work to sit upright this way. But this posture is one of the optimal postures for really deep, deep relaxation. So part of it is you get this physical benefits from it. But you also get some, and as you work through those physical benefits, it's also a training to meet yourself in a very deep way. So if a person goes around being fearful all the time and their shoulders are up high, bent forward like this, kind of rounded forward, and then you sit down and you're told to sit straight, upright, and have your shoulders kind of hang and roll back a little bit, that goes against the way that this attitude of fear is holding you. And so you have to encounter that fear, that way of holding you. If you sit on the couch to meditate and you kind of roll back against the backrest and your shoulders then naturally roll forward, you don't get to meet that fearful part of your shoulders. But if you sit upright and allow yourself to relax, then slowly or quickly start feeling that tension, that holding that's there in the shoulders, and you get to meet that and work with it. And not only you work with the physicality of it, because the physical is so closely connected to the psychological, you also then begin to work with the psychological thing that's going on. I spent a lot of time working with my belly. I had a lot of tension in my belly when I was first many years of meditation practice. Tension from fear. And it was kind of chronic and automatic. After a while, I learned to relax it, and it'd be relaxed for a few moments, and then it would tighten up again. So this meditation posture where the stomach hangs forward a little bit, is more open and kind of exposed, is a wonderful place to explore this area of tension there, and this is how tense, how relaxed am I there in the stomach. And so if you sit upright, you can feel that. Again, if you're bent over, all curled over, you're not going to have a chance to feel the place of that tension there because there's no room for it to relax. You're all kind of collapsed in on it, folding in on it. So part of the value of it, being careful about your posture in meditation, is a training to work with your psychology from the inside, from the outside in, to confront and meet this stuff. And I think that meditation can be a very deep form of body work. And people who do a lot of meditation and are careful with their posture and meditation, they develop this yogic body. And their body changes and shifts over the years. And it's a beautiful thing that can happen. That shift and change and the softening and the opening and the aligning that can happen. So we take so it doesn't mean that you have to sit cross-legged on the floor. I'm not trying to champion that today. But even for people who sit in the chair, some care and attention to how you sit in the chair so you can optimize the postural part of the training is really, really well worth it. Some people sit in the chairs and just kind of rely so much in the chair that they're not really cultivating choice, not really cultivating some inner sense of self-reliance, inner stability, inner strength. Not really sitting in a chair so they can meet themselves in some full way. Sometimes people collapse into the chair almost to avoid themselves, to escape. Oh, to finally get to relax and not, deal with stuff. That's what meditation is about, right? Just calm and don't deal with anything. That's what people think. But meditation is really about dealing with yourself in a very honest and direct way and working through things to find the deeper peace, not the superficial peace of relief, but the deeper peace of release. For people sitting on the cross-legged, or I think for anybody meditating, one of the classic models for meditation posture we have is the Buddha image, the Buddha statue of the Buddha. And there's no other image for Buddhism that represents Buddhism more than the Buddha, seated meditating Buddha. People put it now in their gardens. You get garden Buddhas. You get advertisements. You see it in sometimes store windows. It's popular, this figure, the Buddha meditating. And so it kind of represents, Buddhism's often seen as being a meditative tradition by its symbol. And it's interesting to compare the physical form, the human form, that's used to symbolize different religions and see what's being expressed, what's being taught through that form. Of course, we know in Christianity, one of the most common forms that represents Christianity is Christ crucified. In Hinduism, sometimes it's sometimes Shiva dancing, and Confucius was it sometimes a sage, you know, with a long beard. I'm not sure, but different religions have these kind of archetypes that aren't just there as symbols, but also they're teaching something. They're expressing some very important value, and of the particular tradition. And so we have here this Buddha statue. And the Buddha statue is teaching something to us by the very shape and form it's in. Because remember, posture is an avenue, is a gate into the mind, into the deep recesses of the mind. The deep depth of the mind is expressed through posture. So before I want to talk a little bit about this statue and what can be taught by it. But I'd like to read two people's encounter with the Buddha statue. This is from a book by Sangharakshita. There's a still alive, who's a very very senior Buddhist teacher in England. And he writes, "I am reminded of a French Buddhist nun whom I knew in Kalimpong in the 1950s. She told me that in her student days in Paris, she used to like visiting museums and art galleries, which is how she found herself eventually in the Guimet Museum of Oriental Art. She was a rather militant, aggressive woman. She told me she used to go around with a pair of ice skates in which to defend herself if she was attacked. Well, I thought if I carried these skates with me, if anyone tried to attack me, I'd slash the blades across his face. But as she strode along the galleries of the Guimet, having left the skates in the cloakroom, looking to left and right rather fiercely, as she usually did, suddenly she encountered an image of the Buddha. From her description, I gathered that it was an image from ancient Cambodia. She just turned a corner, and there was a celebrated smile, faint and delicate and rather withdrawn, so characteristic of this Khmer style of sculpture. The whole expression of the face is intensely peaceful. This image, the face of this image, just stopped her in her tracks. She told me that she stood looking at it without moving, almost without blinking, for 45 minutes. She couldn't take her eyes off it. The impression of peace, tranquility, and wisdom that emanated, that streamed in, as it were, from those features, was so strong that she couldn't pull herself away. She hadn't yet studied anything about Buddhism, but as soon as she saw this image, she felt compelled to ask herself, what is it that gives its expression to this image? What is it trying to tell me? What depths of experience does it come from? What could the sculpture have experienced to be able to express something like this? Confronted by this embodiment of awakening, she could not move away unchanged. In fact, it determined the whole subsequent course of her life." It's quite a story. So when's the last time you looked that carefully at a Buddha statue? So one of the things it's teaching us is the possibility of peace, tranquility. And some people see that in certain statues. Some statues more than others. I've had similar experience of seeing certain Buddha statues, and you've been really, I don't know, captivated is the right word, but really struck by how much something in the statue is resonating with something deep inside of me. And for me, it's never been the face so much, but oddly enough, it's certain statues have something about how the chest has been sculpted. And that is meaningful for me because so much of my inner meditative life has to do with my breathing and the beautiful feelings that come with breathing. And so some statues somehow, for whatever reason, resonate with that feeling in me when I look at the chest. Why that is, I don't know. And I've stood and just looked at statues for a long time, kind of feeling that communion with my own breathing, looking at it. So what's being taught in the statue? One is that the Buddha is sitting on the ground. The Buddha spent a lifetime wandering around India and often sitting on the ground. There's beautiful stories of him sitting in the woods under a tree with his monks and nuns around him in the woods, all of them on the ground, sitting together. And there's something about sitting on the ground, directly on the ground, which is very meaningful. It imparts something. For one thing, it provides us with a connection with nature, with the ground, in a very direct and immediate way. It's also a kind of a feeling of being rooted, grounded, this low center of gravity. It's also, in a certain kind of way, a little bit humbling. Maybe that's not the right word, but I don't think of the Buddha exactly as humble, but certainly not the opposite of humble. There's a way in which when everyone's on the ground together, there's a kind of equality that's set in place. Whereas sometimes from chairs, we have higher and lower chairs and this and that, and so much posturing can go on. But when you put get everybody down on the ground, you know, a certain kind of equality gets set in that's different than, you know, you can try that next time you know, going to meet the CEO of a big company. You know, rather than meeting her in her office, take her outside and sit her on the grass outside. Just you and her on the grass and have a conversation. It's a whole different thing will happen. So it's on the ground. And then there's a strong stability, this base, this tripod, which creates almost like a pyramid effect. And you have then this stability from being having a wide, firm base. So we do that in our meditation as well. But the idea is to sit in such a way that we're really grounded with a firm, strong base. Suzuki Roshi once said, "I trust two things. I trust my butt on my cushion, and I trust my feet on the ground." And that's kind of an interesting statement for a great Zen master. So again, I'm being really here, rooted, present, here. And then the way that the hands come together and the feet come together, they come together in the same, more or less in the same place. The hands on top of the feet together, especially if you're sitting a full lotus, both feet come up. And there's a collectedness that goes on. You're stable, but you're also collected in. So rather than being dispersed and all kinds of going out in all kinds of directions, you know, you could meditate, I guess, like this, you know. Like, you know, hands are flailing. But I don't think that would, you know, help you become very deeply grounded or settled. But to be collected, collected in a nice way, pulled in, settled, having everything kind of harmonized or cooperating in this process of being settled and collected, being here, being focused. And it's also the hands go right in front of the lower belly, you know, beneath the stomach. And often the Buddha has a little teeny bit of a pudgy stomach. I take that to be kind of relaxed, just kind of floating, broad kind of stomach that then provides a base, a soft base, for holding up the rest of the torso. So again, the soft belly, the relaxed belly, it's there. And it kind of, in certain kind of cultures, it's rather unbecoming to have your belly go forward, flop forward. But in meditation cultures, that's good. You know, to have your, be unbecoming. And in fact, in Japan, in maybe the 1400s or so, they decided having a big pot belly was a sign of having a lot of chi, a lot of ki, a lot of energy, the spiritual energy in your belly. So they went and redid a lot of the certain kinds of sculpture. And they made a little kind of, you know, like half circle. And they stuck it on their belly to give them a pot belly. And you can see some of these statues, you can see kind of where it's been added on to show that they had good spiritual energy. Anyway, relaxed and soft there. And also the hands and the feet come together very close to this place, the center point, center of balance, center of life, center of strength, the hara area, we call it in Japanese the hara. It's a very important area to kind of be present there and connected there and grounded there. A lot of inner strength can come from being grounded here in your lower belly. And so you have this wide base, this firm base of the legs and the hands. And then you try to be very careful with the balance of your weight through your spine so that the weight of your body kind of goes through the vertebrae of your spine. And that also helps create a nice feeling. It allows you to optimize the possibility of softening, relaxing the area of your stomach. And that becomes a very, very healthy thing to do for going really deep in meditation. And then the Buddha's chest is often he has kind of a big chest. It's sometimes called the lion's chest. And it's meant to express confidence, that you sit there with confidence, with presence. You're not caved in, not lack of confidence, not puffed up. It's supposed to be that big, but open and present. It also means a certain level of trust. You're taking a posture of trust. To have your belly relaxed and your chest open requires trust. And some people would say confidence. And that's a huge training for some people, to be able to find that ability to sit in an open, trusting way. Some people prefer to sit in closed ways because they feel more protected, more defended. They don't want to be open. It's too exposed. It's too dangerous to sit in the kind of open way. But the posture is teaching us to sit open and confident, open and trusting. And for that, that's a meeting where there's a lot of training that goes on. I'm not saying it's easy, but I'm saying confronting that part of ourselves, we might feel afraid or feel like we have to defend ourselves, and working with that is a very important part of this practice of the posture. And then the shoulders are relaxed. They're very relaxed. Generally, the shoulders are kind of sloping down, and both shoulders are equal. One's not higher than the other. They're equally balanced. It's supposed to be symbolic of balance, being completely balanced. So you're sitting there in a balanced way, both balanced in terms of your weight and your position, but also balanced psychologically. So you're sitting in a trying to sit in a balanced, full way. And then his eyes. Generally, in these kind of statues, the Buddha's eyes are half open. And the half open means that he's very present, but he's not caught up in the world, but he's also not caught up in the inner world. And he's not withdrawn from the world, but he's sitting there present and alert. So that posture, the overall posture itself, is someone who's composed, settled, present, confident, and not withdrawn. Really here. They're taking a position. They're here unapologetically, without defense. And the eyes are open, meaning they're alert. It's meant to be an alert posture. And so the open eyes are symbolic of this alert quality of being that's not just in the eyes, not just in the mind, but in the whole body is alert, alive, energized in a certain way. You're kind of sensing, you're tuning into the world, you're aware of the world, attentive to the world, to yourself, through all the pores of your body, through all the muscles of your body. Everything is participating. And this has been a very important, continues to be a very important part of my meditation, is the way in which I tune in to my posture and the aliveness of my posture, what's going on in my posture, paying attention to it. And one of the ways I get concentrated and settled in meditation, one way is through my attention to my posture. It's sometimes kind of like a background approach or background support to getting concentrated. Because it's so internalized in me now that I don't think about it too much. I might be thinking or focusing mostly on my breathing, but the posture is there in the background supporting that attempt to be present and concentrated. And then the eyes are, there's kind of a half smile in the mouth. It's kind of a half smile. And this is the smile of peace, of happiness, of love, compassion, delight that comes from this way of being in the world. So it's not meant to be someone who's withdrawn from the world, but it's not meant to be someone who is caught up in the world. But it's this wonderful balance of being in between those two, of being fully rooted here and then available and present for the world as it comes to us. The last thing I'll mention here is the teaching thing, is those long earlobes. And it's said that the Buddha has long earlobes because before he became a renunciant, he was a prince who had a lot of jewelry, and he had really heavy earrings. And the earrings, stretched his earlobes, and they got really long. So what you see there is the consequence of his life of indulgence. You know, you have to be careful. You know, there might be long-term consequences. And also, also symbolic there of that there is a degree of renunciation going on here, of letting go. That it isn't just a matter of, well, I'm just meditating with all my toys and all my stuff and all my everything. But there is a healthy, I think that's the statue is supposed to symbolize, a healthy degree of letting go of what is not needed. So you can see that still in his ears. He's let go of his jewelry. So we take this posture. We try to take this posture or to use this posture. We look at this posture, the statue. And I love the idea of mirror neurons. So maybe one of the reasons why some people resonate with the statue sometimes, or certain statues, is because it excites their mirror neurons. And so we can resonate with some possibility in ourselves. And so what is that possibility in you of being composed, being present, being confident here? And how can you manifest that through your posture? Because ultimately the statue of the Buddha is not so important. What's important is how you practice with this. And as Suzuki Roshi said, when you bow to the Buddha statue, you're really bowing to yourself. Can you see yourself in that statue? Can you find that in yourself, those qualities? So I'd like to end with another story, another account, mirror neuron account. And this is from Thomas Merton. And he did, it's called the Asian Journal. He went to, right near the end of his life, he died in Thailand. He went traveling, did a Buddhist tour of Buddhist sites and places. And he was very interested in Buddhism, tour of sites in Asia. And he was in Sri Lanka, and he wrote this. The path dips down to the monastery. A wide, quiet hollow surrounded with trees. A low outcrop of rock with a cave cut into it. And beside the cave, a big seated Buddha on the left and a reclining Buddha on the right. I am able to approach the Buddhas barefoot and undisturbed, my feet in wet grass, wet sand. Then the silence of the extraordinary faces, the great smiles, huge and yet subtle, filled with every possibility, questioning nothing, knowing everything, rejecting nothing, the peace not of emotional resignation, but of liberation, that has seen through every question without trying to discredit anyone or anything, without refutation, without establishing some other argument. For the doctrinaire, the mind that needs well-established positions, such peace, such silence can be frightening. I was knocked over with a rush of relief and thankfulness at the obvious clarity of the figures, the clarity and fluidity of shape and line, the design of the monumental bodies composed into the rock shape and landscape, figure, rock, and tree. So, may the wonderful posture of the Buddha become your posture in the way that's appropriate for your body, not for his. May you find it in you. May it come out of you. And may you train, may you challenge yourself, may you work with the difficulties and the strains and the tensions of your body so you can find that inner peace and possibility of a liberated mind. Your posture, your body, is your great support and help in this whole endeavor. Don't leave your body behind. So that's only about half of what I want to say about this very important topic. You know, I've been dealing with this for over 30 years, so I have a lot to say, built up. But and maybe at some point, maybe in a month or two, I'll revisit this. Next week I won't be here. And then when I come back in April, the reason I can't pick up posture again is I committed myself to give a series of talks for the month of April, Mondays in the month of April, on loving kindness practice. So we'll do that, and then maybe we'll get back to the posture. So, thank you.